try to say you gon' ride with me. You flip-flopping like hip-hop, I don't get locked in that trick box. Get got like Big and Pop, it's got to stop. I am the people, not the big, I repeat after Fred. So please blow my brains out if I ever forget.
I'm with the independent thinkers, I'm down with the movers and the shakers and the ex-handy drinkers, the non-smokers, the health advocates, the non-voters, the young bloods in the hood training like soldiers. I'm on the side of the tracks with the hood guards, the little child that don't color inside the margins.
And you have been listening to Rebel Diaz Radio Special Thanksgiving Remix Edition here on WBAI New York. Coming up at midnight, Health Action, followed by Hour of the Wolf, Science Fiction, etc. with Jim Freund. Yes, Lister will be along with Burn Baby Burn at 3 a.m. and at 6 o'clock, Project Censored. That's our overnight tonight. Stay tuned to WBAI New York.
On November 24th to December 10th at the Cinema Village, Mist Harlem, and Teachers College Columbia University celebrate Black life on the big screen with the African Diaspora International Film Festival. Discover over 60 entertaining and revealing fiction and documentary films, including 34 U.S. and New York premieres such as Mama Africa, Miriam Makeba, Sammy Davis Jr., I've Gotta Be Me, the Canadian political satire, Black Cop, and more. The African Diaspora International Film Festival from November 24th to December 10th. For tickets and schedule, go online to myadiff.org or call 212-864-1760. Enjoy your world on the big screen.
WBAI, New York.
We're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
Welcome to Health Action here on listener-supported community radio WBAI in New York. I'm Mark Hannay, Director of Metro New York Healthcare for All, and a member of the Health Action Collective that brings you this program every week. In this week's program, we're going to be taking a look at a couple of issues that are becoming prominent here in the United States. First, one very much of concern to many consumers, and that is the whole issue of the high cost of prescription drug prices and what can be done about it, particularly what states are beginning to do about it, since the federal government doesn't seem to be doing much of anything these days, nor inclined to do so under the current political context. And in our second interview, we'll be taking a look at the whole question of value in healthcare. What are we getting for what we're paying for? What can patients do in the healthcare setting? And what do we need system elements and government to do to help us make sure that we get better quality healthcare? But first, we'll start with the Health Action News for this week, taken from stories posted to KaiserHealthNews.org. As children move through adolescence, some face health hurdles like obesity, sexually transmitted diseases, depression, and drug abuse. Regular checkups can help families address such problems, and the Affordable Care Act has paved the way by requiring insurers to fully cover well-child visits at no charge to patients. However, both before and after the act was established, fewer than half of kids ages 10 to 17 are actually getting routine annual physical exams, according to a recent study published online this month in JAMA Pediatrics. Researchers analyzed data from the Federal Medical Expenditure Panel Survey, which tracks health insurance coverage and healthcare use and spending. Before the law passed in 2010, caregivers reported that only 41% of adolescents had a well child visit in the previous year. After the law's preventive services protections became effective in 2011, the rate climbed to only 48%, a moderate increase. The increase was greatest for minority and low-income groups. Still, more than half the children in the survey didn't go to the doctor for routine care over the course of a year, even though many families gained insurance and wouldn't have owed anything for the visit. A primary care provider can screen adolescents for risky behaviors and treat them if necessary. A checkup is also an opportunity to educate patients on health and healthy behaviors. About a fifth of adolescents aged 12 to 19 are obese, and between 13 to 20% have a mental health disorder in any given year, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Young children typically do have regular pediatrician visits for recommended vaccines, hearing and vision tests, as well as school checkups. But those needs change as children age into adolescence, and state requirements that kids get physicals before entering school may vary and vary by year to year. The new healthcare law requires that most healthcare plans cover preventive services recommended by four medical and scientific expert groups without charging anything out of pocket. For children, many of these services are spelled out in the Bright Futures Project Guidelines, sponsored by the American Academy of Pediatrics and supported by the federal government and by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. As the Trump administration and Republicans in Congress look to scale back Medicaid, many voters and state lawmakers across the country are moving to make it bigger. Earlier this month, Maine voters approved a ballot measure to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, and advocates are now looking to follow suit with ballot measures in Utah, Missouri, and Idaho in 2018. Virginia may also have another go at Medicaid expansion after voters elected a Democratic governor and Democrats made significant inroads in the state legislature. However, a new study from the Urban Institute may shed light on why Medicaid eligibility remains a pressing problem, the question of medical debt. While personal debts related to health care are on the decline overall, they remain far higher in states that haven't yet expanded Medicaid. Researchers at the University of Minnesota studied financial data from 2012 to 2015 for people who would be eligible for Medicaid where it was expanded. They found that states that didn't expand, the lower percentage of low-income non-elderly adults with unpaid medical bills dropped from 47 to 40% within 3 years. Where they did expand it, it fell by almost twice as much. Those states saw the average drop 13 points from 43 to 30%. Medicaid, as opposed to private insurance, is the key, according to the Urban Institute, because it requires little out-of-pocket costs. Even if Medicaid patients need lots of care, they aren't on the hook for big out-of-pocket costs in the same way someone with private insurance might be. Republicans failed proposals in Congress earlier this year to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act would have eliminated or limited Medicaid expansion, and that would have affected the last few years' downward trend in medical debt. However, Medicaid's debt-reducing advantages over private insurance could still disappear under the leadership of the Trump administration. Shortly after Seema Verma was confirmed as the administrator for the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, she and Dr. Tom Price, the head of the Department of Health and Human Services, sent a letter to state governors outlining the Trump administration's plans for Medicaid. Their letter encouraged states to consider measures that would make their Medicaid programs operate more like private commercial health insurance, including introducing premiums and co-payments for emergency room visits. The letter claimed that by giving people more on Medicaid more quote-unquote skin in the game, they would take more responsibility for the cost of their own care and thereby save the government money. And finally, the Association Press reports that Roman Catholicism's Pope Francis last week urged lawmakers worldwide to ensure that healthcare laws protect the common good, decrying the fact that in many places only the privileged can afford sophisticated medical treatments. The Pope's comment came as U.S. lawmakers have been debating how to overhaul the nation's health insurance laws. In a message to a medical association meeting at the Vatican, Pope Francis expressed dismay at what he called the tendency toward growing inequality in health care. He said in wealthier countries, health care access risks being more dependent on people's money than their need for treatment. Without citing any particular nations, Pope Francis said the health care laws must take a broad and comprehensive view of what is most effectively promotes the common good in each situation, including looking out for society's most vulnerable citizens. The Vatican meeting also explored end-of-life issues, and the Pope repeated decades-old teaching forbidding euthanasia. Using his nearly five-year-old papacy to highlight the plight of the poor, Pope Francis later made a surprise visit to an area near St. Peter's Basilica where volunteer doctors are giving poor people medical exams as part of the church's first-ever World Day for the Poor. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first segment taking a look at what's going on with high drug prices here in the U.S. and what can be done about it. Stay tuned. And welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In the first segment of this week's program, we're going to be taking a look at prescription drug issues, particularly around the prices of prescription drugs and a new report that's come out that has some suggestions about what can be done about it, particularly at the state level. Joining us is Jill Zorn, who's the Senior Policy Officer with the Universal Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut, one of the organizations that produced the report. Welcome to Health Action, Jill.
Thanks so much, Mark.
So before we get into it, can you tell us the elevator speech about your foundation and who you are and what you do?
Sure. Well, Universal Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut, we like to call ourselves an activist foundation. We were formed around the year 2000 when Anthem bought our nonprofit Blue Cross Blue Shield. And we tried to hold on to some of the assets that organization had built up over the years. And like I like to say, sometimes use them for good, not for evil.
Great.
So we are dedicated to quality, affordable health care for all and health in Connecticut.
Great. Well, let's move on to the topic at hand. Before we get into the particulars of your report, maybe just let's paint the broader landscape. What's going on with drug prices in America?
Really? Well, I would say, you know, here at the foundation, we started to look at this issue a couple of years ago, and that's because we were starting to focus on healthcare costs. I mean, we want to get to universal healthcare, of course, it's in our name. But to get to universal healthcare, it's not only going to be about coverage for everyone, it's also got to be about affordable coverage. And right now, this country, we have the highest cost of any country in the world for healthcare, and our outcomes are lousy. So, you know, trying to look at cost and why is healthcare so expensive in this country, you pretty quickly zoom in on we have a lot of monopolies that are basically able to raise their prices and charge whatever they want. And if you think about it, I know even in New York, hospital systems are really starting to consolidate. So you've got monopolies in the hospital world. You obviously have them in the insurance world. And drug corporations, those are the most obvious monopolies of all. Not only are they all consolidating, but each time they develop a new drug, we hand them a monopoly in the form of a patent, and then we let them charge whatever the heck they want for that drug. So we shouldn't be surprised that we're in the situation we're in right now.
So what are the impacts of that on patients?
Well, we see a couple of things going on. First of all, everyone is noticing that the cost of insurance is going up and up. And a lot of that is not really just the insurance companies themselves. It's because the cost of healthcare is getting more expensive. And the fastest growing part of healthcare costs is drug costs. So premiums are going up. And then the other thing that where people, I think, are really starting to notice is that if you have what you thought was good health insurance, over time, people's benefits are changing, and they're to try to cope with the fact that prescription drug costs are so high, they're starting to shift more and more of the cost onto people. So instead of just having, say, a $5 copay or a $10 copay, if you're taking an expensive drug, all of a sudden you're finding you have what they call co-insurance. You might have to pay 50% of the cost of the drug when you go pick it up. And some of these drugs cost $2,000 or $3,000 a month. So people, especially if you have a chronic illness and you need to take an expensive medication, people are really starting to notice that their out-of-pocket costs are going through the roof.
So your report talks about a bit of public opinion research about what people think about this issue. What are some of the general findings that are out there?
Well, I mean, people are really mad about this issue, and you can look up a number of different polls to see that. I know in the report itself, we talk about 1 in 4 Americans currently taking prescription drugs is reporting difficulty affording them. And the whole point of having health insurance is so that you can get the care that you need. And if people are starting to not fill their prescriptions because they can't afford them, then we're just back in the situation that we were, you know, before we expanded coverage to a whole lot more people. And then I think it sometimes shows up as the number one issue that people care about. Of you know many different issues in the country. It's definitely people are mad. I think they definitely noticed when the EpiPen crisis happened. I guess that was maybe about a year and a half ago. That was kind of a symptom of the fact that people are noticing and they are mad and they want something to be done about it.
So there are two broad categories that the report lays out of things that public officials, either at the federal or state level, could do to address the high cost of drugs. The first one is what's called fair pricing. Talk to us a little bit about what that approach looks like.
Well, sure. And I think, you know, one thing is that ultimately, I think the best way to solve this problem is for the federal government to take action. But as you know, Mark, that's not likely to happen anytime soon. I mean, the new nominee to run the Health and Human Services Department is a former drug company exec. So I don't think we're going to see change at the federal level anytime soon. So therefore, it's the states that are starting to try to take action. And with fair pricing, I mean, that's basically the idea of somehow regulating the price. Really, prescription drugs ought to be thought about like a public utility where, say, the cost of electricity is regulated. But here's something that people depend on actually for their life, and there's no regulation of the price at all. So what some states are looking at is at least trying to get information about the price hikes and that are happening in drugs that their residents are going to have to pay for, and trying to say that, hey, that price increase that you are saying you're going to do is too high. You can't do it in our state. So that's the goal of these type of laws. It's really in the early stages right now to pass fair pricing regulation. in states, and the number one state that has done it so far is Maryland. And they passed a law that's focused only on generic drugs. But as this paper says, the paper that we worked on with the Yale Global Health Justice Partnership and the National Physicians Alliance gives the theory that it might be possible for states to regulate the more expensive, you know, brand name drugs too. We're just not sure yet. It has to be tried and see what happens.
So what exactly has Maryland done?
Well, they passed a law that said if a generic drug price goes up, and I don't remember exactly, by a certain amount, their attorney general can basically sue. And there's, you know, if it goes up by an unconscionable amount. And, of course, the first thing that happened when this law passed is that the drug industry sued to stop the law. So far, the law is going into effect, but they aren't done fighting it out in the courts. But that's the basic idea, is that if a price increase is above a threshold that is set in the law, that the attorney general could sue to stop it.
And when we look at the issue of pricing, there's different kinds of prices. There's sort of existing prices, and then there's new prices. Tease that out a little bit for us.
Well, one of the big problems is that a new drug could be launched at an incredibly high price. And one of the things that was really noticed a few years ago when the drugs came out that actually cure hepatitis C, which is a huge breakthrough, a huge medical breakthrough to be able to cure hepatitis C. But the price for those drugs was set at $80,000. And other countries are not paying $80,000 for the same medication. Plus, if you really think about it, taxpayers in the United States already paid for a lot of the research that was fundamental to finding that drug in the first place. So we helped fund the research, and now we're supposed to pay $80,000 for something that we actually helped to fund, just so a drug corporation can make a huge profit. It's just really outrageous.
And then the other thing we're seeing is existing drugs that have been on the market are also going up. What's that all
exactly
about?
Well, the typical brand name drug, it's very common for them to have two price increases a year. And I don't know a lot of other commodities or even services that raise their prices twice a year. And it's just regular, like clockwork. Twice a year, all these prices go up. And if you just add that in over time, prices just keep getting higher. Another thing we see, I used to work at the National Multiple Sclerosis Society before I worked here at the foundation, and I was reading up on their drugs recently, and there's a lot of and new drugs are coming out every year almost to try to have an impact on MS. And when I worked there about 10 years ago, these drugs, they were already expensive. They were maybe $1,000 a month. But now the typical cost for a year for an MS drug is $80,000. And that's whether the drug's been around for 10 or 15 years or whether it's brand new. You see all the drugs that address MS, kind of they're all raising their prices together. So the idea of quote-unquote competition doesn't really seem to work. Instead, they seem to just be able to keep raising their prices. So the huge price increases are happening on existing drugs as well as new drugs, on something like insulin, which insulin's been around forever. But the price increases on insulin have really been steep, and they're just adding up over time.
Now, generic drugs are supposed to be the sort of safety valve, if you will, on this pricing thing. Once drug companies lose a patent on a drug, then other manufacturers can step in and offer these drugs, presumably at a much lower price. Is that what really happens?
It doesn't seem to. I mean, one problem is there seems to be a backlog at the federal government to approve generic drugs, and I've been reading about that. That's been in the news lately. And supposedly the FDA, the new FDA commissioner is trying to work on that. But there is a backlog. But the other thing that is happening is sometimes the brand name drug will buy up the generic rights and try to slow down anyone going to market to produce a generic to compete with the brand name. And then you even see sometimes where someone will buy up whatever generic options they are for one particular drug and turn it into a monopoly and then raise the prices incredibly. That's what happened. That's what basically what Martin Shkreli did a couple years ago that got him into so much trouble with raising the price of a drug that is really important to AIDS patients and had been around for years and was not very expensive. And then all of a sudden, he bought it up, turned it into a monopoly, and decided to jack up the price to something outrageous. So generics are not enough. They help, and certainly there are many generic drugs on the market now that have made a difference, but it isn't making enough of a difference.
Now, second area that your report focuses on is the issue of what's called transparency, so that we can sort of see what's going on around drug prices. Can you give us a little bit of an understanding of what these bills are trying to do?
Well, the challenge to get to fair pricing is that nobody knows what the price is of a drug. So it's different for every insurance company negotiates a different deal with the drug manufacturers to buy a certain drug. And there's actually a middle, an organization that gets in the middle that does some of these negotiations. It's called a pharmacy benefit manager, PBM. And they're actually sort of created a whole business of doing drug price negotiation on behalf of insurance companies or large employers that are buying prescription drugs for their members. And they negotiate secret deals that involve getting a rebate. So whatever the list price is, then now you get, they negotiate a rebate, but no one knows what the rebate is. And so the whole price of the drug is completely obscure and not known. So if you're going to try to regulate the price increases, you have to know what it costs. So that's a challenge in itself, unfortunately. Another part of the transparency movement is to try to get a better handle on just the manufacturers themselves. What is going into creating a new drug? How much does it cost? You know, a certain drug that you just jacked up the price on, or you launched at a huge launch price. How much did it cost you to really make that drug? What are the actual costs of research and development? What is known generally is that as much as the pharmaceutical industry likes to say that, well, you're paying for innovation and that's really priceless, it turns out almost all drug companies spend more on marketing and on lobbying together than they do on research and development. So understanding more, getting more transparency about what actually goes into setting a price or to justifying a price increase could help with, you know, the first thing we talked about, fair pricing. But it's tricky because a lot of this pricing information right now is quote unquote a trade secret. And so there's a lot of lawyers that are going to get very busy and are already getting very busy as these issues are coming to a head and states are trying to figure out effective legislation.
Well, have some states been able to break through on this transparency issue at all? And if so, what have they done? How have they done it?
Yeah. Well, the biggest news, the most exciting news was that California, which is big enough to be, you know, I guess it's even bigger than New York, Mark.
It is.
California was able to pass a huge price transparency bill. And that just happened, I think, maybe in June. And that was despite over $17 million of lobbying costs spent by the pharmaceutical industry to try to stop the bill. They passed a bill that basically is going to require revealing prices to a regulatory body. So they won't be necessarily becoming public, but they will be have to be released to a regulatory body. And they basically requiring that if there is a big price increase, and I think it's like if prices go up more than 16%, I think, in a two-year period, something like that, then they're asking the corporation that did that price increase to justify it. So how do you explain why you're jacking up the price like this? Now, what they didn't get is like, okay, now what comes next after they get that justification? You know, are they going to regulate? I mean, that's a logical next step. And California didn't pass a law like that yet, but their transparency law is the most effective one that's been passed so far, and other states are really looking at it. And right now we're waiting to see, are they going to be sued by the pharmaceutical industry? So far they haven't, but that doesn't mean that it isn't going to happen. So sometimes these states just have to go out and try something, and we're all, you know, many other states are watching that law and already starting to talk about passing similar laws. So the California law is really, really an exciting one and worth people, you know, looking into a little more.
So I guess the report final section is on recommendations. Let's kind of take them. The first one is about what states could and should do about pricing for both patented and brand name drugs. We've talked a little bit about this, but maybe summarize for us what states could and should do.
Well, this paper is definitely recommending that, unlike the Maryland law, which just addresses price gouging for generic drugs, this paper, which was written by law students and law faculty at Yale, as well as some public health students. So, I mean, but these people, they know they're legal eagles. So they looked into the precedents and the patent law, and they recommend that it is definitely worth a try for a state to regulate brand name drugs also, not just generics. And so I think that's their number one recommendation there.
And the second recommendation is about this issue of transparency.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that. Maybe summarize for us.
Well, this paper really did focus on getting more transparency about what goes into manufacturers' costs, including their marketing costs, you know, what their true research and development costs were, so that to try to get more information to really force the question of about why is it that you're charging such a high price when we can see this is what your costs actually are. And then the paper talked about trying to make more of that information publicly available. And I think that's obviously the goal, but there's definitely some legal hurdles in the way to doing that. But even if you can get more regulatory groups and, you know, government to have better information, ultimately the public will benefit from that. But that's the main thrust of their transparency recommendations.
Great. Well, we've been talking a little bit about here in this interview segment about the high cost of prescription drugs and what states could and some are doing to address the issue of high drug prices. Our guest has been Jill Zorin, Senior Policy Officer with the Universal Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of an overview here on the subject, Jill.
My pleasure, Mark. Thanks for reaching out.
You're welcome. And we'll be back with our second interview segment, taking a look at the whole question of value in healthcare. Stay tuned. Thanks, Jill. Have a good one. Welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In the second interview of this week's program, we're going to be taking a look at the whole question of value in healthcare. What does it mean? We all know it's kind of instinctually that there's probably a problem here, or at least something that needs to be addressed. Joining us is Lynn Quincy, who's director of the Healthcare Value Hub with the Altarum Institute, to help us sort it all out. Lynn, welcome to Health Action.
Thank you, Mark.
So before we get into the topic at hand, can you tell us a little bit about your project, the Healthcare Value Hub?
I would love to. I know we're going to talk about what healthcare value is, so I'm going to skip over that for now. We are a center funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and it's designed to we look at the evidence around interventions that have been purported to address very high healthcare prices, unwarranted variation in healthcare prices, the delivery of harmful healthcare services, all those things that deliver poor value to consumers. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation feels that if someone is staying on top of what the evidence says, they can then push it back out in an understandable way, and maybe we can get good private practices and policies that actually get us to better healthcare value.
So before we get into the particulars, if I'm a regular patient, or what is the research show that you've been looking at for regular patients, what do they think value means?
That is a great question. And you touched on it in your introduction. Concerns about affording health care are top of mind for consumers. We have poll after poll that shows that. There's qualitative research that shows that. And these fears are very well founded. Consumers get a bit of a raw deal when it comes to healthcare. We do have, if you're very, very sick, we do have some of the best healthcare in the world. That is correct. But once you look past that, we pay the highest prices in the world for our healthcare. Our quality is very uneven, and we don't actually deliver preventive care and all those upstream high-value services that we want patients to consume at the right level. So the whole picture isn't rosy once you get past the very technical care that we're able to deliver to very sick people, very complex patients. And we think consumers are harmed by not doing a better job of when they touch the healthcare system, they know that they're going to get exactly the right care for a reasonable price. That's the place we want to get to.
Yes, exactly. So what are we getting for? What are we paying for? The other way to think about value is, and you mentioned this or alluded to it at least, beyond the patient, is the healthcare system where we all turn to get those services. Is there a difference between how the system looks at value versus how patients look at value?
Well, yes and no. That's another great question. As you said at the beginning, patients instinctively sort of know when they're getting a good value. They approach a healthcare encounter very holistically. They want a provider that listens to them. They want to feel they've had sufficient time with the provider. They expect a state-of-the-art outcome. They would not expect their provider to not be following the current best practices. And the health system knows they should be doing that, but honestly, the health system struggles to deliver the value that patients are expecting. One reason is the way we pay our doctors and hospitals. We still have a lot of places where we're paying a doctor or a lab or another entity like that for every service that's delivered. That's called fee-for-service. And that encourages the delivery of a lot of services, maybe more than we need. In addition, that payment approach really doesn't say anything about quality. What kind of quality did we get for those services? And it doesn't necessarily do anything about prices, ensuring that we don't overpay each time we go to the doctor. So on the system level, we are struggling as a country to kind of get to that value as perceived by consumers. They're looking at all sorts of things like, let's pay providers differently. Let's have more transparency with respect to prices and with respect to quality. Let's begin to bundle things up so that instead of paying 100 CPT codes inside of somebody who needed a knee replacement, we're going to pay one price for all the services and procedures, both hospital and doctor, that are needed for a knee replacement. They're also looking at what we call upstream approaches. are people able to live healthy lives where they live and work and play? So a host of things going on in the hopes that this will add up to much better healthcare value, but it can be uneven depending on where you live. There's lots of work to do in this area.
And how are various elements of the healthcare system responding to this new initiative around quality, this new focus on
Well, oh, go ahead, Mark.
No, I'm saying, yeah, just focus on it.
Well, we see a lot of different responses. So one thing that I'll pull out is led by our Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, that's within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, they stopped paying for really egregious medical errors. Things like you're in for an amputation and they cut off the wrong limb, or you're given the wrong blood type or in a transfusion or something like that. And because there is no longer any reimbursement by some payers for these types of errors, the error rate is going down. They're responding to that signal. They've also stopped paying for readmissions that are believed to not be merited. If the first admission had been done properly, if discharge instructions had been done correctly, then we wouldn't have expected to see a readmission. And when they see those types of readmissions, those unexpected readmissions, they've stopped paying for those. And other payers, other insurance companies are paying attention. So we're also seeing some responsiveness and changes in treatment patterns there. But in other areas where they're trying things, the response has been very slow. So it's kind of a big complex web of things being tried, sometimes with success, sometimes without success, which is why it's really useful to have entities like the Healthcare Value Hub trying to stay on top of it all.
which begs the question, like, before we move on, like, where do you think we are now in the whole process?
Wow. Well,
are we making progress, I guess I should say?
Yes. I think we are making progress. I think it's slow, but I do think we, compared to 10 years ago, we have an evidence base that tells us what we should be doing and what we shouldn't be doing that is much, much stronger. And we still have a gray area where we're not really, the evidence doesn't seem to add up to a clear direction yet, but that's getting smaller all the time. It's very hard to enact change. So different areas of the country are moving at different speeds. We have states like Vermont and Massachusetts are in a position to really stay on top of healthcare spending in the state, looking across all their payers. They're able to see where the hot spots are, and they're able to take an action if the rate of spending seems unreasonable. And they are able to take actions that are pretty well grounded in the evidence. So that's very encouraging. And I think a lot of states are going to go down that path where you have some sort of oversight of spending in general in the state, not just Medicaid. Other states, sometimes at the state level, not much is happening, but you'll have a community level effort where they've successfully gathered stakeholders together, your hospital stakeholders, your employer stakeholders, all in the service of a public health goal, and we're seeing success in some of those efforts. So there's a lot of encouraging signs. It's probably hard for the patient, the regular patient, the regular consumer to see how it all adds up, but another 10 years from now, I think the changes will be noticeable on the ground.
So let's talk a little bit about patients. Your website lists some ways that people can take some patient actions in terms of trying to make sure they get the best quality and affordable services. Let's sort of take these maybe one by one. The first area you talk about is when you have an office visit with your provider. Typically, this is a physician or a nurse practitioner or someone like that. What are some things that patients can do to help sure that they get value in that setting?
So first of all, for your listeners, let me just tell you how you would go to the website. Our website is www.healthcarevaluehub.org. And if you go to /actions, you can see the list that Mark and I are talking about. So in response to your question, Mark, there's a lot that patients can do in the doctor's office. And patients are going to have varying degrees of comfort with respect to asking questions about these questions of their doctor. But there are some tips for having these types of communications on the website that will, I think, be of some help. So the patients should always ask why a given treatment is being recommended and how it's going to improve their outcome. Ideally, patients will have a really good handle on the tests and scans and lab work that has already been done, so nothing is ordered that is duplicative. Doctors are supposed to have access to your full medical record, but for reasons of systems not talking to each other, that's not always the case. So it's very good as a fundamental question is to find out why a recommended test or treatment is being recommended, its impact on your outcome, and then if you think it's already been done, you should speak up at that time. We also have a list of what are called the Choosing Wisely services. This it sounds like they're services you want, but in reality, physician specialty societies and others have come together to identify the services that are overprescribed and are typically unnecessary. And there's like a little wallet card you can get to see what these are. And if you're recommended that you get a service that's on this list, you absolutely should push back. Patient harm can arise when you are getting a medical service that was not needed to begin with. So we do want to be careful as patients.
And then the next thing, so you go to your office, doctor's office, you have a session with him or her. They recommend some treatment, you agree on it and so forth, where it's going to be done and like that. Then typically, often, they give you a prescription for a medicine and or they'll take some blood out of you and send it to a lab. What are some questions that or things patients should be thinking about around those issues?
Well, here is a key one. It might surprise your listeners to learn. If you're given a prescription, always ask the pharmacist if there is a equally good but cheaper option available. In many states, pharmacists are actually gagged from providing this information, although states are starting to pass laws that prevent that from happening. But if you ask, they are allowed to tell you what the cheapest, best option is. So you have nothing to lose by asking that question. There is also a website you can go to. It's called goodrx.com to compare prices. And this is a good idea. Consumer Reports has done some investigative work and found that prices for some common prescriptions really vary. And sometimes, well, just for example, they'll find that you can get something very cheaply at Costco and it's quite a bit more at CVS. That's just an example. But a key tip would be to use one of these sites to shop around and to ask the pharmacist you're standing across the counter from if they can recommend a cheaper option.
So, and what about for lab work? Or do we have much choice in that anymore? Or is it all just sort of built into your health plan?
Well, chances are the doctor will choose the lab that your lab work is sent to, but you can insist that lab be in network, and and sometimes, you know, depending on how broad or narrow your health plan's network is, that may be easy to accomplish or hard. But patients are, if you get hit with an out-of-network lab fee, it's going to be very large and very not consumer-friendly. So work with your doctor to ensure that those labs are going to an in-network lab.
The next thing would be referrals that your primary care doctor would make either to specialists or hospitals. What sorts of things can patients be doing to help assure they get value around those sorts of referrals?
So doctors, again, this is probably a bit surprising. Doctors are a lot like patients in the sense that they don't have good information about who the high-value specialists are out there. They may not know who the most expensive is. They may not even know who's producing the best outcomes. We're all kind of navigating this world in a blinded fashion. So keep that in mind. I would ask your doctor for a recommendation as far as a specialist goes, but I would also get opinions of others. If you have access to anybody else in the local health community, or maybe you have neighbors who've had a similar procedure, your outcome is going to vary depending on who you go to, and I would get some other recommendations beyond just those from your doctor as a way of making that decision.
And would it be similar for hospitals, or are there some additional considerations there?
Well, hospitals, that's a good question. So some listeners are going to be in a community, well, maybe not in the New York metro area, but more generally, where they may not have a choice of hospital.
Right.
If you do have a choice of hospital, it's a little easier to get information on outcomes and quality for hospitals, and I would absolutely look at that information. It, depending on what the procedure is that you're going in for, you may be able to find quality information specific to that type of procedure, or you might have to look at more general information. But if you have multiple hospitals, I think you will be able to find highly usable and actionable information on quality.
So let's say I've done all my homework. I'm needing a hospitalization for something, a scheduled procedure. And I've selected the hospital I'm going to, and I'm now in the hospital. How do I make sure I get good quality care in that setting?
So there's a number of things you can do. One of the best things you can do is have a friend who serves as your informal advocate. When people are in the hospital, they feel very vulnerable, they may be in pain, they may feel very sick, and they're really, they don't feel in a good position to argue with hospital staff if they feel that's merited. So the best thing you can do is to have someone who's there who is serving as your advocate if you're feeling too that you're not up to it. So experts have recommended that people keep track of everything that happens in the hospital. When you get that hospital bill, it's going to list a lot of things, and some things may be surprising, and everything is going to be expensive. So patients should push back if they see something on that bill that doesn't look like something they received while they were in the hospital. There are, on our website, there's a checklist. We link to a checklist about how to keep safe in the hospital. These are things even as basic as hand washing, how to have conversations with hospital staff so that they do everything they need to keep you safe, keep you from getting an infection. So there's actually quite a bit to do. Any hospital stay, it's a very important time to do some of the things on these lists.
Your site also talks about some things that government can do to help us improve value and quality in the system. Let's kind of run down those one by one. One is, you mentioned earlier, the issue of trying to stay in network and what happens if you unexpectedly end up using services out of network and get what's called a surprise bill. So I guess the question would be, what's the recommendation for patients to do in that circumstance?
Great question. The about a third on surveys, patients have reported that about a third of them get a bill that they weren't expecting. And a particularly egregious type of surprise bill is when patients get a bill from an out-of-network provider. So this could be, let's say, an out-of-network anesthesiologist or emergency room doctor. And they weren't expecting that because they were getting their services at an in-network hospital. There is, it's very difficult under those circumstances for a patient to avoid that type of encounter because, you know, they may not have even ever remembered meeting this person. And legislatures, especially state legislators all around the country, are very interested in this problem. There's a lot of sympathy to it. There are a lot of states that are doing work to limit the harm that can come to consumers. So if this has happened to you, I would absolutely get involved in what are called a surprise medical bill campaign in your state. Again, there's a lot of legislative sympathy to this type of problem, and we're seeing a lot of progress making things better for consumers all around the country.
And just to let people know, here in New York, we actually pioneered a model surprise bill and have a whole system in place if you get a surprise bill of how to appeal that and get yourself out of the middle of the fight between the providers and the insurance companies. So make use of that. Second area you talk about in terms of things government could do is around patient safety in hospitals. You talked about, you know, how what patients can do, but what could government do?
Oh, a lot. It is unfortunate and probably surprising how many medical errors are still happening in our hospital system. The Institutes of Medicine did a report, I think it was in 1999, and they had a call to action that this was just completely unacceptable. And we've made surprisingly little progress since then. People will often compare our hospital, the safety problems in hospitals, to the airline industry, where through the use of training and checklists and redundancies and human-centered design, airline travel is very, very safe. And the advocates in this area really want to bring that level of scrutiny to hospital safety. And this, again, will vary a lot at the state level. States have different rules and regulations and reporting requirements for hospital safety. There's also some federal work in this area. Certain types of medical harm are reported up to the CDC, for example. Our Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services tracks some of this and will refuse to pay for certain types of errors, like I mentioned earlier. But it is definitely needs to be a louder, more consistent, and faster operating campaign.
And lastly, we've got about a minute left. What about the issue of prices versus cost in the system? Does anybody have any idea, or is this just really kind of a black box?
Oh, great question. You may know, your listeners may know, that we have tremendous price variation within for the same service in the same local area. An economist would say this is a sign of market failure. And for the regular patient, you can say not all of these prices can be right. They can't be justified by the underlying cost of care. Prices can vary by as much as 600%, again, for the same service in the same local area. You can't see this because most prices are hidden. But it's a huge problem that our legislators do need to deal with because it isn't going to be solved by the market. We've seen that since we have had this problem with excessive price variation for decades now. So another issue that is being looked at the local level and the state level and some attention at the federal level. There have been a lot of congressional hearings, for example, on this problem, but not too much action at the federal level yet.
Great. Well, thank you. We've been talking with Lynn Quincy, director of the Healthcare Value Hub, about efforts to improve value in healthcare at our system, both for what patients themselves can do and what the system itself and lawmakers can do. Thanks so much for joining us and giving us a bit of an overview on Health Action, Lynn.
My pleasure, Mark.
And we'll be back with some closing thoughts in a moment. Stay tuned. That'll do it for Health Action this week. Thanks for joining us. Next week, we'll be doing our annual World AIDS Day special, so please join us for that. Bob Letter and I will be here with that program. Thanks to Reggie Johnson for engineering and editing this week's program. I'm Mark Hanning.
Here are some words that matter to all of us at WBAI. Listener supported, commercial free, resistance radio. Hi, my name is Catherine. I'm host of Heart of Mind, which you can hear on Mondays at 1 p.m. Please take a minute to consider what your radio landscape would look like without this station. At WBAI, we consider you a part of our vital community, a vital cog in our radio wheel. At WBAI, we keep it grassroots. We're powered by your generosity, not corporate interests. Remember to donate by visiting give2wbai.org or pledge right now. from your smartphone by texting WBAI to 41444. We thank you in advance.
Hey, this is Fernando.
This is Gabriel.
And I'm Nick.
And we are WBAI interns.
On a mission to recruit more BAI buddies to support our station.
A BAI buddy is someone who signs up to make a reoccurring monthly donation to WBAI. It's safe, secure, simple, automatic, and means a great deal to keeping our unique essential programming on the air.
To become a BAI buddy, just go to WBAI.org to sign up. Or, if you prefer to sign up through the phone, you may call our call center at 516-620-3602.
Once you join, you will receive a BAI buddy card that allows you to take advantages of member benefits and special opportunities both on and off air, plus a tote bag.
Questions? Just email buddy at WBAI.org. And remember, your support helps keep us on the air.
Now listen up, sweetheart. If you board that plane without making a donation to WBAI, one of these days you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon, and for the rest of your life. WBAI is the only station with the guts and determination to seriously challenge this nightmare Trump. The rest of the media are cowards. It's the voice of the poor, oppressed, downtrodden, and the imprisoned.
You know, Rick, this fella Trump is bad news. He's worse than Major Strasser.
Act occasionally. Why don't you make a donation?
I already did at give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org.
Louie, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
There is nothing wrong with your radio. Do not attempt to switch the station. You are locked into our frequency at 99.5 on your FM dial. If we wish to make it louder, we can turn up the volume. If we wish to make it softer, we can tune it to a whisper. We can take the music and change it to fit all that we want you to hear throughout the course of this broadcast. We can take the music and change it from vintage psychedelia to soft, mystical reggae. We can transform a 60s classic and propel the song right into modern times. For the remainder of the program, sit quietly and we will control all that you hear. You will experience the awe and mystery that takes you from the depth of night and covers your entire body with morning dew. WBAI, New York.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This is a recorded program. Our guest will be S.A. Chakraborty. Stay tuned. And once again, good morning. So this is one of those rare occasions in which I have pre-produced this program. In fact, today it is Wednesday, so it's only broadcast, about 9 hours after I'm speaking these very words. But it makes things a lot easier, especially on what comes out to being a holiday morning. And because our guest, S.A. Chakraborty, was not able to make it to tonight to the station, we pre-recorded our interview by Skype last Monday. Now, I hate doing what they call phoners, and I guess that would now be Skypers, but the sound quality is better than it has been in recent times, and also this isn't an author I haven't met. That's a rule. I'm not going to interview you remotely unless we have met somehow. And even then, I'm not as good at what I do when doing it in that manner. So, there. So, let's see. This all came as a result of... So, Shan read for us 2 weeks ago, along with the amazing and wonderful Chris Dykeman, who is one of the great artists. She did the logo, that is the Hour of the Wolf logo, as a matter of fact. But first, let's tell you a little bit more about the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, because we have one coming up ere long on December 5th. And that's usually our family special, our family being Delia Sherman and Ellen Kushner, but they are in Paris, so they're spending quite some time there, and I hope having a wonderful time. So we're going to have a festive event instead, and Sarah Pinsker is going to perform music, and Kat Valenti is bringing in a game show. Let me tell you about these folk. Sarah Pinsker is the author of the Nebula Award-winning novelette, Our Lady of the Open Road, and the Theodore Sturgeon Award-winning novelette, Enjoy Knowing the Abyss Behind. Her stories have appeared in Asimov's, Strange Horizons, Fantasy and Science Fiction, Lightspeed, and Uncanny, among others, and in anthologies including Long Hidden and New Voices of Fantasy. She is also a singer-songwriter and toured nationally behind 3 albums on various independent labels. A fourth is forthcoming. She lives with her wife and dog in Baltimore, Maryland. Find her online at sarahpinsker.com and on Twitter at S-A-R-A-H P-I-N-S-K-E-R. And then the second half of the show, Catherine M. Valenti, the New York Times bestselling author of over 24 works of fiction and poetry, including Palimpsest, The Orphan's Tale series, Deathless, Radiance, and the crowd-funded phenomenon The Girl Who Circumnavigated Fairyland in a Ship of Her Own Making, and the four books that followed it. She is the winner of the Andre Norton Tiptree Sturgeon Pre-Imaginal Yugi Foster Memorial, Mythopoeic, Riesling, Lambda, Locus, Romantic Times, Critic Choice, and Hugo Awards. She has been a finalist for the Nebula and World Fantasy Awards. She lives on an island off the coast of Maine with a small but growing menagerie of beasts, some of which are human. And Sarah will be singing, and Kat will be presenting a quiz show, which is incredible fun. I saw her do this at ReaderCon, and her partner Heath and Sarah will be two of the contestants, and we'll find out who the others are. So that's December 5th, 7 p.m. at 388 Atlantic Avenue. Admission is free, and we will look at you dolefully. Dolefully, in order to try to get contributions to keep the reading series going. So, speaking of those reading series, we were very, very pleased. I'll talk about it during the interview, but much earlier this year, I met Shan Chakraborty as Cam Roberson put together an incredible evening of different writers. I was not familiar with them, except for Harris Durrani, who I have to have live on the show sometime. And I thought that Shan was incredible. And her novel has now come out. I've been pressing, when are you going to do my show? And she said, when my novel comes out. Well, her novel came out last week, and at the time of the reading, would be coming out in 1 week. So you can figure out that it came out on, November 14th. S.A. Chakraborty is a fantasy writer from New York City. Her debut, The City of Brass, is the first book. You know what? I don't have to do all of this, because Amy Goldschlager, who substituted for me 2 weeks ago, I had thrown out my back, does the introduction herself. So, hey, let's just set your Wayback Machine for a couple of weeks ago, and let's enjoy Shan's reading.
Okay, I think we are going to get started again. Now we have our second reader, who I'm going to introduce. She can still be in a lovely picture that Melissa's taking. All right. It's okay. You're doing your business. You know, and I actually did not thank Melissa Beckman, who is our official photographer for this series. She always does a beautiful job. Of course, I say that because I use one of her shots as a headshot, but that is just me. Anyway, S.A. Chakraborty is a fantasy writer from New York. Her debut, The City of Brass, is the first book in the Devabad trilogy? Devabad trilogy. An epic fantasy set in the 18th century Middle East that will be published in November 2017. I think it's just days away. I'm very excited about it personally. By Harper Voyager. When not buried in books about Mughal portraiture and Omani history, S.A. enjoys hiking, knitting, and cooking unnecessarily complicated meals for her family. You can find her online at sachakraborty.com or on Twitter at @schakrabs, where she likes to ramble about history, politics, and Islamic art. Shannon is a proud member of the Brooklyn Speculative Fiction Writers Group, which really is a great group. So, you know.
Thank you for introducing me, and thank you all for coming out on this absolutely terrible night. So, I appreciate that. I am actually going to start from the beginning of my novel, and since it was just introduced, I don't really need to talk about it. And I'm going to apologize if my voice sounds a little off. I'm getting over a cold. But, okay. Okay. So. He was an easy mark. Nahri smiled behind her veil, watching the two men bicker as they approached her stall. The younger one glanced anxiously down the alley, while the older man, her client, sweated in the cool dawn air. Save for the men, the alley was empty. Fajr had already been called, and anyone devout enough for public prayer, not that there were many in her neighborhood, was already ensconced in a small mosque at the end of the street. She fought a yawn. Nahri was not one for dawn prayer, but her client had chosen the early hour and paid handsomely for discretion. She studied the men as they approached, noting their light features and the cut of their expensive coats.